Welcome back to the Tap Room exclusive. I'm Dean Zarbaugh. I'm here at Bottle House Brewery and Meadery. I'm here with Jason and Brian, and now we are moving on to ciders. I've had a few, not as familiar with it as some other styles. For people who might not be familiar, spiked cider, so you make it with apple, you got some alcohol content. Talk to the people about the different kinds. You do more than one kind, and a lot of locally sourced ingredients too as well, right?
Let me just start real quick and distinguish between two things, an apple ale and an apple in a cider. What you see on the shelf in most cases in the six pack of cans that are pretty much all over the place now are apple ales. And before Jason gets going on this, because he's our cider maker, and I think it was kind of the same farm he gets the honey from, this old man is growing apples, so I think Jason saw this as an opportunity and made 100 gallons of it from this guy's cider, his heirloom ciders, or apples. But in any case, real quick, the apple ales you see are not apple ciders. They are made with buckwheat syrup and regular old apples, not apples that are appropriate for cider. And I just want to make that distinction real quick, because it's a confusion in the market right now, and it's a big distinction.
I have a tendency to rant when it comes to apples. A woman called me from, I think it was Cleveland Magazine, and she's like, oh, I'm doing a blurb about cider and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, do you have a minute? I talked to her for 45 minutes about I don't even know what. So I can kind of stop me if I get going here. Very simply, cider is made from alcohol made from apples, in the way that wine is alcohol made from grapes. That is the basic definition. Obviously, there's a lot you can do with that. Cider is a very interesting kind of drink, especially in America, because it was the national drink of this country for hundreds of years. And Prohibition kind of killed that. So there were these fantastic orchards all from where we are now in Ohio up into the New England area that were chopped down. Just like you can't make very good wine from Concord grapes, you can't necessarily make very good cider from Red Delicious. The apples that we know, these grocery store apples that are great for certain things, Honeycrisp and Red Delicious, and they're great for applesauce, they're great for pies, whatever else. They can make alcohol, but the alcohol's not that good.
Right.
The varieties that are made, that you can make cider out of, that's kind of their only purpose. In the same way, you don't go, when you're buying grapes at the store, you're not picking up, they're not Cabernet Sauvignon. And so these apples taste terrible. They're usually called spitters because they're very bitter and they're very tart, but they make fantastic alcohol. They've been doing this in England and France and Spain and parts of Germany for forever, and these were made in America. We just lost the trees. So there's a kind of a cider revival going on that's kind of the horse is a bit ahead of the cart on the quality of the apples that's available. You can make a good cider with those apples, but to make, in my opinion, a really great cider, you need to have the apples. My kind of journey with this started, I think it was 2015, so we'd had our mead license for a year, and Brian came to me and said, with our winery license, you're allowed to make cider, so I think that's an opportunity. I think people would like that. We should look into it. And I did, and maybe to the economic chagrin of Bottle House, I read this book by this a guy from Quebec who was very influenced by the French tradition. And I said, man, if I'm going to make cider, I really want to make it this way. And I searched high and low and just could not find the apples. And I'd almost given up. And then our beekeeper, Jerry, calls me up and he's, hey, Jason, I got some apples if you're interested. That's exactly what he sounds like. And I kind of thought, Jerry, what are you going to have there? Some whatever. And I was desperate, so I said, sure, I'll take them. And I go there, and I asked, you wouldn't happen to know what varieties you'd have, dude? And he lists off 12 fantastic heirloom varieties. He planted the trees 50 years ago, never had a pesticide, never been treated in any way, and the cider was just excellent. And so we haven't always, his crop died the following 2 years, and so we've looked elsewhere for the juice and tried to do the best we can, but just this last fall, created a really, really excellent relationship with an orchard out in Toledo. Mm-hmm. So I think the best cideries in the country are usually orchards who are like estate wineries. They're growing their own apples, they're pressing them on site, and they're in total control of the whole process. We don't have that luxury at this time. So the next best thing is finding an orchard keeper who's really committed to the craft. And I have no idea why they're growing these apples, because they don't have no intention of making cider. And I said, why do you have Ashmead's Kernel and Bramley's Seedling and Roxbury Russet? They said, we read about it and they sound interesting. And I said, okay, can we buy all of them? And they said, yes.
Wow.
So we made 250 gallons of cider with them last year. We're hoping to 1,000 this year. That cider turned out excellent. We won a gold medal for it at the Glen Cap International Cider Competition in Michigan. I don't know. I can say more. I don't know if someone else is chiming in here.
No, I think the way Brian started off this segment is very appropriate. I've found myself that I've learned a lot about cider myself in the last 4 years. My first introduction really to it was a chance meeting with Richard Reed over at Griffin Cider Works in sure. Lakewood, who is an Englishman making English-style ales in America and in Ohio. I'm using mostly all Ohio apples. And I find that cider makers are very, very passionate about the difference between the stuff you find in your local grocery store, the red apple ales, the Angry Orchards, the national brands, and what a true cider is. Passionate.
I had a couple eye-opening experiences. When we first decided to do it, I wasn't really very keen on the idea. My sister-in-law lives in London, and we were traveling. We were in a market there, and there was a woman with these massive wooden barrels of cider, and one said dry and one said off dry. And these were like, 300 gallon tanks of cider. She's just pouring right out of the thing. And this was like West Country scrumpy. It was super interesting, funky, weird, really, really tasty cider. And I said, I like that. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a big fan of Strongbow and Magners and the ciders we think of. Then kind of that led me to trying French ciders. So we're not, which are a whole other ballgame, and we're not, necessarily making those kind of, we can't make French cider because we can't get French cider apples. But we're definitely inspired by those kind of styles. So we like to make dry ciders. We make to make ciders that have a really nice balance of bitterness and acidity. I think it's just a totally untapped world. And there's so much education that can go, into the cider world. And so we're just kind of at the tip of the iceberg with this. And that's, I think, somewhere where we have a lot of room to grow. And, being a tap room model is great because, you can have a cider on the shelf next to 10 other things, whether they're apple ales, whether they're real cider, whether they're well-made or not. And you can't really communicate your brand in the same way that our bartenders and I can from behind the bar. So when someone orders a cider, we can talk about what that means.
I think it's important, you get a lot of guys that'll, an apple ale, hey, people like it, we should just, shut up and just drink it, essentially. But I think, there because you can make something doesn't necessarily mean you should. Right now there's a resurgence and a popularity for cider, so you get a lot of breweries that are, they're not getting winery license. They're just simply making barley apple things and passing it off as cider. And it's unfortunate because, like Jason said earlier, it's a great comparison. You wouldn't make wine out of grape concentrate and Concord grape juice,
and buckwheat and rice. If you tried to sell a wine that was 50% rice,
you would say, crazy. But so I think that it's educating the public on what a real cider is and why the cost is there and what goes into it it's important.
It's also really exciting because when you taste a real cider, it's kind of like nothing you've tasted before. Right. And they're hard to describe in some ways because how many ways can you describe apple flavor? And there's a million other things there as well. But what we find is generally when people have these, the people who are drinking cider are often looking for something sweeter, looking for something familiar like an Angry Orchard or a Strongbow, looking for something gluten-free. And sometimes they're thinking doesn't go much beyond that. Like, so the most important thing of what they're drinking is that it's gluten-free. The quality of the product isn't necessarily as important. So when you can, whether they know it or not, a lot of times I don't need to sit there and give this spiel to everyone who walks in the bar. I'll just give them the cider. And then they might come back and be like, you know, this is really good, right? You know, this is better than what I normally drink. And then you can have the conversation, you know, after that fact.
Yeah, you bring that up, that, you know, the flavor profile, I guess, and how many different ways can you describe an apple? What are we drinking here right now? Because honestly, this is a cider, correct?
It is.
And so, if you had told me that I was drinking an apple cider here, yeah, I probably would have never guessed that.
So this is a unique one that I like a lot. It's called Requiem. This is a kind of a cider-wine hybrid. I'm from Toronto, and so I go up there to visit family quite often, and there's a bar there that's probably the best cider bar maybe in the world. It's insane. They've got an unbelievably well-curated selection. All their cocktails are made with apple whiskeys and apple brandies, and they've got 200-300 ciders from around the world, and just, you know, the entire staff goes to an orchard every week to go test and whatever. And so I was there years ago, and they had a cider that had, I think, 10% Pinot Noir in it. And it was really interesting, and it was a great balance because it was still apple forward, but that grape layer was there as well. And I stole the idea. And this is kind of inspired by that. So this is, it's an apple fermentation. So it's apples with cider yeast. And then at the tail end of that fermentation, I add in three kinds of Great Lakes grown red grapes. And then our house red wine yeast that we use for the mead. And so it undergoes a second fermentation. And so what you get there is an interesting fruity balance. So when you smell it, it's still a lot of apple. But there are these underlying fruit and acid notes from the grapes that are just kind of fun. So I thought that was a really interesting cider.
When you say it goes through a second fermentation, I'm still new to a lot of this, so if I ask a dumb question, I do apologize. But what does the second fermentation do for the cider?
Every time you're fermenting, you're creating additional flavors and aroma, and you're also consuming sugars to turn into alcohol. So if I had done the first fermentation, added all the grapes, and then just stopped there, we would be left with is a fairly sweet cider with lots of grape juice in it. So by fermenting it again, you're going to get not just the characteristics of the first fermentation with the cider yeast, but then the wine yeast will add its own kind of layers.
Yeah.
I mean, we've done something like that with certain of our beers. Our Belgian triple, we do a double fermentation. So we start with one yeast, and then about halfway through, we start introducing honey and a second yeast. It's just, I don't know, fun.
It's complexity and layer.
Like I said, I'm still new to it, so I'm still learning a lot of these things and trying to expand my knowledge base a little bit. And a little piece by piece, these episodes are kind of putting some stuff together. I have heard of people doing second fermentations and stuff like that, but I always forget to ask the question when it gets there.
I mean, there's parallels across everything we've discussed today. So Jason just mentioned a clean beer that we double ferment. Sour beers go through a continual second fermentation in the barrel. You're putting, you know, fermented beer in those barrels, and then they're going undergoing another fermentation for, you know, up to a couple of years. So in the same with the meads. I mean, Jason's, when he's making a mead with Melomel with fruit additions or going into barrels after primary fermentation, you know, you're always getting these different layers that are added through secondary and tertiary fermentations.
Very interesting. And Rob, anything that you had as far as more questions for ciders?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I was actually just about to. So yeah. I'll give a little a plug here. So unfortunately, the ciders that I love to drink are really, really not very available. The apples that we're talking about are in scarce supply. There are orchards in certain areas like New England that are making these things that don't get distributed very much. So once a year, you might find some things on the shelf that are excellent. It's tough to find this kind of stuff, and it's almost like it's unfortunate when you get the taste for them, because then you don't really want to drink the other stuff, but then you can't find what you want to drink. One local example of a guy who's doing a fantastic job is Matt down at Bent Ladder Ciders and Wine. They're in Rittman, Ohio, yep. And so Rittman Orchards is their family farm. Him and his brother inherited it. They tend the orchard. They have been doing the cider now for 2 years. And he makes fantastic ciders. His heirloom ciders, he does a variety, but his heirloom stuff's just fantastic.
I've been meaning to get out and check them out. Dean asked me if I had any more questions. I blanked out and I said I didn't, but I guess I do have one more follow-up question. So my wife is gluten-free.
Sure.
And I know a lot of people probably come into your brewery looking, don't drink beer, looking for something that's gluten-free. Can you throw a percentage possibly on the total percentage of your business that is cider? 10%, 15%? Is there?
It could be much more, but just based on the limited amount of cider that we can get. And again, last year we did about 300 gallons from Johnston.
And I think we did about 500 gallons of cider total. Now keep in mind, most of our meads are also gluten free. So I'd say mead's about 20-25% of our sales.
Not quite that high. It's 15-20 if you include cider.
Okay.
So, but there seems to be a limitless. There's no ceiling on the cider front, especially when you start doing the things that Jason's bringing in. The fruited ciders and so it's not just a traditional cider. When you have some options, people choose.
Yeah, I think talking about real cider is not real cider. There's a line that you can kind of cross. I think getting people interested in good cider is a great thing. So fruit cider is a fantastic way to do that. And there are great ways to introduce fruit that complement the flavors of the apples and all these kind of things. So we do a variety of fruit ciders along with the traditional stuff that really help to get new cider drinkers kind of excited. So.
It's really the limiting factor when you talk about cider is the availability of the heirloom apples. So it's as much as we can get, we can pretty much make and sell.
And a great thing that's kind of come about now since I last recorded, Destination Cleveland and the Ohio Craft Brewers Association came out with the brewery passport for Cleveland, and you guys are lucky enough to be on there. It's a new thing that's just launched pretty recently, within the last few weeks.
Literally.
Brand new, but how good has the how much has this increased people coming in the door, and what have been some of the added benefits from this on your guys' end?
Well, Jason spends Wednesdays behind the bar, and I think he has a lot of real good insight with this one.
Yeah, I mean, I've only worked a couple shifts with this thing, and last night alone, Wednesday nights are an okay night for us, but at least a dozen people came in, on a Wednesday. The bartenders tell me that on the weekends it's more than that. I was just at our Lakewood location, and he said, 15 people a day easily are coming in for the first time. And we're getting people, last night I had someone from Avon and someone from Chagrin. So these aren't people just down the street who didn't know we exist. They're people who are really now traveling around the area. One couple had, they did a little brewery hop. They hit three breweries that day that they had never been to before and, had a really good experience. And we're getting people who I think they like us because with the meads and sours, we're offering something also a little bit differently. So, and we bottle so much of our product that you can kind of take some things with you as well, so you don't have to, drink a whole bottle of mead and drive back to Avon. So
I think that's the beauty of these passport things that are now coming out, and it kind of started with the Columbus Ale Trail and then Summit Brew Path last year, and now it's rolling up into Cleveland for the first time. And I know when I first met you about a year ago, I kind of reached out to you and said, hey, is anybody in Cleveland doing anything like this?
Yeah.
Because it's blown up in Akron, Canton, and those breweries are doing phenomenal because of that. And I think that kind of speaks to, people kind of tend to get into their own shell, live in their own neighborhoods. And so if you are in Middleburg Heights, you probably go to Fatheads a lot. And if you live downtown Cleveland, you probably go to those breweries a lot. And the nice thing about these passports is it really starts to get people out of their own neighborhood and going to a place that they never have been before.
Beer tourism is a real economic driver. And the best thing you can do is to make it easy for people. So there are going to be people who want to visit breweries, and the passport's not for Rob and I, because Rob and I, if I'll sniff out a brewery, before they're open, and we'll go find it, and that's, it's for the people who you're right, they're in their comfort zones, and they would go to something new, but are they going to sit on Google to try and find these things and search out the hours and know, oh, do they have a restaurant? Do they have this? What are their, and so all the information is just right there, and It makes planning trips just super easy.
And it speaks to the growth in the brewing industry. You couldn't do the brewery passport 4 or 5 years ago in Cleveland. Right. You'd be like five guys. You'd get five stamps and you'd be done. So, it's just I think it's a symptom of a bigger problem.
Yeah, it gets you out.
It's a good problem.
And it's a good
problem. It's a great problem to have.
It's a fantastic problem.
And like you said, it kind of gets you out into new neighborhoods and stuff, too. It's like, I like Willoughby Brewing Company. Will I go out to Willoughby every day? Probably not. But it gives me an excuse to go there and try something that I may not have tried, or visit a place I have not tried.
Sure.
Because I've had their beer, or I've had your guys' beer or something. I live in Lakewood, so I'm right by the Lakewood location. I live right on Madison, actually, so like it's pretty close. But you're not always looking to go out somewhere far away, and this kind of gives you a nice reason to get out there and see something new.
It kind of helps you figure out what's out in your own neighborhood, something that's nearby. Maybe you live in Lakewood and you didn't know there was a brewery over in Avon, so you go over and check out Avon Brewing. I mean, and there's another tourism passport down near Mahoning Valley, and that's the State Line Brewers Guild, and then they have 14 breweries that straddle the PA and Ohio line. I probably would have never gone to Minerva, Ohio, and visited Sandy Springs. I probably would never even heard of Minerva before that passport came along, you know? So it's something you make a day out of, you know? You get in your car, and you go out and check out a new brewery, and while you're down there, you check out the downtown scene, you do some shopping, you maybe buy something in one of the local boutiques, and it's one of those things that just kind of builds upon itself.
It's also nice, you know, when you look at the map, so you can say, yeah, I've been to Willoughby, but there's now multiple breweries in Willoughby.
Right.
You know, we were the only brewery in Cleveland Heights. Now there's multiple breweries here. And you can kind of be like, oh, man, I've been meaning to get out there, but it's like, am I going to drive a half hour to go to one brewery? Well, to go check out two, I can, you know, pop into both, and then suddenly it makes it a bit more attractive.
Yeah. And the brewery passport's uniting Cleveland.
Uniting Cleveland from east to west.
The east to west is final.
It gets people to cross the river.
It does.
That's which exciting. Which we couldn't get people to do, is why we had to build a place on the west side.
Yeah, that's right.
Got to get the best of both worlds, right? Everybody kind of wants, like we were saying, stay in their own little world. Anything else that I might not have covered here before we get going?
Yeah, I got one more thing. So we talked about east side, west side. You guys have your location over here in Cleveland Heights. Of course, you got the Bottle House Brewery over in Lakewood. Talk to us about this new project over in Van Aken and Shaker Heights.
Yeah, so that's what thing I wanted to add. We are about to start construction on a really cool new project. It's not going to be a Bottle House per se, but it is going to be run, owned and operated by us. We're opening a bar called Craft Collective that is hopefully going to curate a really fantastic selection that embodies everything we've talked about in these last four segments, and what we think is really high quality in the drinks industry. It's going to be part of the Van Aken development in Shaker Heights at Sugar Inn in Warrensville. We're going to be an anchor business in this 20,000 square foot market food hall. So there's going to be food vendors, restaurants, and we're going to be the bar for this whole area. We're putting 30 taps in. We will be a licensed brewery, so the plan is to have oak fooders and barrels for sour aging. So if there's a passport next year, there'll be a Craft Collective stamp in addition to the Bottle House one.
So it almost kind of sounds like what the Bottle House started out as?
A little bit. It's like the Bottle House, what we started at, plus that Keepers of the Craft Fest.
Yes.
You know, we're hoping to be able to highlight some producers that might not necessarily distribute, but we have good relationships with, so we'll be able to bring in really unique unique beers and have a heavy educational aspect. The management team over there really wants to do lots of events, and so mead tastings, cider tastings, beer tastings, things like that, we want to try and do as much as possible.
Yeah, and yeah, Bottle House, our beers will make up a percentage of the tap list, but you know, sours and meads will be kind of the focus, and ciders will be kind of the focus from what we do. We'll have some cleans on, but you know, we got to keep our taps filled on the two tap rooms we already have. But it's an opportunity to expand our community and the Bottle House family, and kind of turn the spotlight on some of the other guys around
the development there.
Area.
They were, you know, in what they're doing differently than some other developments like that. They're trying to really create a place that can be there for a long time. And the businesses they're bringing in are mostly local businesses, and they were attracted to us by the communal aspect that we bring and the sense of kind of authenticity. So, I think the people we're going to be neighbors with are going to be excellent, and I think the community there hopefully will really embrace it, because that neighborhood has needed something desperately.
Yeah.
So,
really exciting.
Congratulations, guys. Really looking forward to seeing that, and best of luck to you, and thank you for taking the time to be here today, and we'll let you know when it's all posted, and have a great night.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot.